ಮುದಚ್ಯತೆ ಪೂರ್ಣಸ್ಯ ಪೂರ್ಣಮಾದಾಯ ಪೂರ್ಣಮೇವಾವಶಿಷ್ಯತೆ. ಓಂ ಶಾಂತಿ ಶಾಂತಿ ಶಾಂತಿಹಿ. ದ ಇನ್ವಿಸಿಬಲ್ ಈಸ್ ದ ಇನ್ಫಿನಿಟ್, ದ ವಿಸಿಬಲ್ ಟೂ ಈಸ್ ದ ಇನ್ಫಿನಿಟ್. ಫ್ರಮ್ ದ ಇನ್ಫಿನಿಟ್ ದ ವಿಸಿಬಲ್ ಯೂನಿವರ್ಸ್ ಆಫ್ ಇನ್ಫಿನಿಟ್ ಎಕ್ಸ್ಟೆನ್ಷನ್ ಹ್ಯಾಸ್ ಕಮ್ ಔಟ್. ದ ಇನ್ಫಿನಿಟ್ ರಿಮೈನ್ಸ್ ಸೇಮ್ ಈವನ್ ಡೋ ದ ಇನ್ಫಿನಿಟ್ ಯೂನಿವರ್ಸ್ ಹ್ಯಾಸ್ ಕಮ್ ಔಟ್ ಆಫ್ ಇಟ್. ಓಂ ಪೀಸ್ ಪೀಸ್ ಪೀಸ್. So last, in the last class, we were trying to deal with the first two verses of this Upanishad. The first verse tells us that the creation is one, the reality is one, the existence is one, and the entire world as such is pervaded by the Divine Spirit. Now here a question, a metaphysical question arises in Advaita philosophy. A very important question. If the world is non-different from God or Atman or the Absolute Reality, then why do we see this world changing, moving, coming into existence, existing for some time, and then vanishing? Everything in this world is moving. So how do we explain this? Vedantins give a very important reply. The world is real as the Atman behind it. It is unreal as world. I shall explain this in the light of a well-known simile in Vedanta. That makes things very clear. In Vedanta, it is called a Rajju Sarpa Bhranti, the imagery of a rope and a snake. Now, you remember, this imagery is as old as 2nd or 1st century AD. Even in the ancient metaphysical works of Nagarjuna, which was perhaps written Madhyamika Kariga, Vigraha Vyavartani, these are some of the important metaphysical works which belong to the Shunyavada. It's called the theory of voidness of the Buddhist. These works were written around 1st or 2nd century AD or the 1st century BC, around this period. The imagery is this. Just think of a room which is dimly light. You can see something. Something is lying there. Something in the shape of a snake. But actually, it's a piece of rope. Now, when you bring light, or when you illumine the room, you understand immediately that it is not a snake, it is only a piece of rope. Now, that object is real as rope and unreal as snake. What we mistook as snake in dim light was in fact rope only. It's not that the rope has come into existence or the snake has vanished. The snake never vanished because to begin with it did not exist. And the rope is not the creation of light. Even if you don't bring light, even if the room is in pitch darkness, the rope will remain a rope. Now the object that we see in dim light is real as rope and unreal as snake. Similarly, this whole world existence, this universe is unreal as universe, but real as Brahman. When you superimpose the characteristics of the changing world on the unchanging reality, that's Brahman, then we visualize the universe. But the moment we see the reality behind the unreal world is Brahman itself, then there is no such thing as Brahma Satyam Jagat Mithya. Then the experience tells us that Brahma Satyam Jagat Satyam. This is the point. So that's why in philosophy we say Brahma Satyam Jagat Mithya. Brahman is the only reality. Jagat as Jagat is unreal. But Jagat as Brahman behind it is real. In fact, that is the experience of Turiyanandaji. Towards the end of his life, he experienced Brahma Satyam Jagat Satyam. This is not Turiyanandaji's contribution. This is already stated in Shankaracharya's commentary very clearly. That is Swarupa Drishtya Satyam. Namarupa Drishtya Mithya. This is the Shankaracharya statement. Anyhow, I will come to that subject. Now, if the entire creation is pervaded by the divine spirit, Isha Vasyam, if it is pervaded by the absolute reality, then what is the status of Jagat? The Jagat also is in fact non-different from Brahman. Therefore, the Jagat is not something to be enjoyed, but something to be enjoyed through the medium of renunciation. In other words, live in this world, work in this world, make the best of this world, but keep in mind that Isha Vasip, this Jagat is pervaded by the Divine Spirit. Then we will not be enslaved by this world. In fact, that is the scheme of metaphysical current in Isha Vasya Upanishad. Isha Vasya Upanishad tells you at the beginning that the entire creation is pervaded by the Divine Spirit. But then it doesn't tell us to run away from the world. It tells us to live in this world, make the best of this world, but at the same time, keep in mind the supreme truth that this world is unreal, but this world as Isha, as God, as Brahman is real. Now, then slowly the Upanishad takes us to the higher level of philosophical speculation. The higher level of philosophical speculation is directly dealt with in the 6th and 7th mantras. I would not come to that at this stage, but I shall refer to that. Then only we will get an idea of the root map of philosophical speculation in the Isha Vasya Upanishad. See, if you look at the 6th and 7th mantra, it tells us the attitude of a man of wisdom who has realized the fact that the world that we live in is pervaded by the Divine Spirit. Yastu sarvani bhutani atmani eva anupasyati sarva bhudeshu cha atmanam tato na vijugupsade. This is the 6th mantra. I should explain this. 7th mantra tells us, Yasmin sarvani bhudani atmaiva bhud vijanataha tatra ko moha kasyoka ekatum anupasyataha. These are the two famous mantras which tells us how a man of supreme wisdom who has realized the spiritual unity of existence looks upon the world, looks upon himself, and looks upon the whole creation. After giving a brief description of the Supreme Atman in the 4th and 5th mantras, the Upanishad tells us in the 6th and 7th mantra how a man of supreme wisdom, a man of spiritual realization, not a man of philosophical conviction, that should be understood. Here, the Upanishad is not describing the attitude of a man of philosophical conviction. It is explaining the attitude of a man of spiritual experience, who has experienced the unity and who is every moment experiencing the unity of himself with the entire creation. Sixth mantra says, Yaha tu sarvani bhutani atmani anupasyati sarvabhudeshu atmanam cha anupasyati saha tataha na vijugupsade. The literal meaning is this. One who experiences the existence of sarvani bhutani, everything in this world, in himself, and who experiences the presence of himself in every living being, that person doesn't hate anyone. He doesn't see anybody as alien to himself, as different or distinct from himself. He cannot hate anyone. He cannot blame anyone, because he doesn't see anything or anybody other than himself. In fact, this mantra is very important from the standpoint of practical Vedanta. In fact, in Swamiji, in his practical Vedanta, makes a very memorable, unforgettable statement. The infinite oneness is the eternal sanction of all morality, all ethics, all good actions. Swamiji says, Advaita experience is the only ultimate touchstone, ultimate criterion of ethics and morality. God cannot enforce ethics and morality. Policemen may be able to do that, but God cannot. If God tells you, I will take you to hell if you do something wrong, and if you reply, well, I don't care if I go to hell, what will God do? God will be helpless. Policemen can threaten you, well, I will take you to jail, I will imprison you, and you may be frightened. But God will be helpless. If you tell God, well, I am ready to go to hell, you take me to hell, I don't mind. I shall rope, I shall kill, I shall do something wrong, I shall commit sin, I don't care if you take me to hell. What will God do? God will be absolutely helpless. So Advaita philosophy takes ethical philosophy to a higher level. It says, you don't injure your neighbor, you love your neighbor, you don't hate your neighbor, you don't commit crime, not because you are afraid of a God who will take you to hell, but rather by injuring your neighbor, you are injuring yourself. By hurting your neighbor, you are hurting yourself. Because your neighbor and yourself are not two different entities. Your neighbor is non-distinct and non-different from yourself. This is the essence of Advaitic concept of the spiritual unity of creation. So such a person, tato na vijugupsade, he doesn't hate anyone. He doesn't look down upon anyone. So this is from the ethical point of view. The seventh mantra, you should remember, I'm just giving you a roadmap of the evolution of philosophy in Isavasya Upanishad in the light of Shankara's philosophy. So if I take one sloka after another, I shall come back to the earlier sloka, third and fourth sloka, I shall come back. But before that, I just want to give you an idea of the steady evolution of metaphysical thought in Isavasya Upanishad. So the sixth mantra explains what Swamiji means when he says that infinite oneness is the eternal sanction of all morality, all ethics, all good actions. Advaita alone can be a permanent foundation for ethical philosophy or moral philosophy. Because it's not based upon a God who punishes you, a God whom you should be afraid of, or a God who may drive you to hell. But rather it is based on the philosophy that the reality is one, creation is one. You can't do injury to anyone, not because you are afraid of the punishment of God, but rather by injuring your neighbor, you are injuring yourself. By hurting your neighbor, you are hurting yourself. Now the seventh mantra tells, Yasmin sarvani bhutani atmaiva bhut vijayanataha tatra കോമോഹക്കശോക ഏകത്വം അനുപശ്യതഃ. ഏകത്വം അനുപശ്യതഃ ഈസ് എ വെരി ഇമ്പോർട്ടന്റ് പോയിന്റ്. ദ വൺ ഹു എക്സ്പീരിയൻസ് പശ്യതി ലിറ്ററലി മീൻസ് സീയിങ്. ബട്ട് പശ്യതി ദാറ്റ് വേർഡ് ആക്ച്വലി ദ ഒറിജിനൽ റൂട്ട് ഈസ് ദൃശ് ധാതു, ആൻഡ് ദൃശ് ധാതു ഈസ് ദി ഫൗണ്ടേഷൻ ഓഫ് ദ വേർഡ് ഇൻ സംസ്കൃത ദർശനം. ദർശനം മീൻസ് നോട്ട് സീയിങ് ബട്ട് എക്സ്പീരിയൻസിങ്. സോ ഏകത്വം അനുപശ്യത മീൻസ് എ പേഴ്സൺ ഹു എക്സ്പീരിയൻസസ് ഏകത്വം. ഏകത്വം മീൻസ് യൂണിറ്റി, സ്പിരിച്വൽ യൂണിറ്റി ഓഫ് ദ ഹോൾ ക്രിയേഷൻ. ദ വൺ ഹു എക്സ്പീരിയൻസസ് ഹിസ് നോൺ ഡിസ്റ്റിങ്ഷൻ, നോൺ ഡിഫറൻസ് ഫ്രം ദ റെസ്റ്റ് ഓഫ് ക്രിയേഷൻ. യസ്മിൻ സർവാണി ഭൂതാനി ആത്മൈവ ഭൂത് വിജാനതഹ. ദ മന്ത്ര ഇസ് ദിസ്: യസ്മിൻ വിജാനതഹ സർവാണി ഭൂതാനി ആത്മ ഏവ അഭൂത് തത്ര ഏകത്വം അനുപശ്യതഹ ക മോഹഃ ക ശോകഃ ശോകഃ. ദിസ് ഇസ് ദി ക്വസ്റ്റ്യൻ. ദിസ് ഇസ് ദി സം കൈൻഡ് ഓഫ് എ ക്വസ്റ്റ്യൻ ദ എൻഡ് ഓഫ് ദി അറ്റ് എൻഡ് ഓഫ് ദി മന്ത്ര. ദ മന്ത്ര കൺക്ലൂഡ്സ് വിത്ത് എ ക്വസ്റ്റ്യൻ. എ മാൻ ഓഫ് വിസ്ഡം, a man who has realized his unity and who is every moment experiencing his unity with the rest of creation, how can such a man of wisdom have any grief, any sorrow? How can he be sorry about anything? How can he have any feeling of grief? That means he will be beyond grief, sorrow, all worries, because every moment he is enjoying the bliss of his unity with the entire creation. Now these two shlokas, these two verses describe the experience of a man who has reached the supreme wisdom. Now how does the Upanishad take an ordinary man to this stage of spiritual experience? That's the next question. Here we have to come to some of the fundamental principles of Hindu social life. In Hindu society, we have the concept of purushartha, means four fundamental values of life. In Sanskrit we call dharma, artha, kama and moksha. Dharma means, let us say, righteousness. Moksha means liberation. Moksha is a transcendental value. Dharma is that fundamental value which should guide our activities while living in this world, in all our worldly pursuits. When we work hard, when we pursue the path of worldly prosperity, status, money, worldly prosperity, enjoyments, all this. When we strive to acquire wealth and enjoy this world, our actions should be guided by certain values. These values are collectively called dharma. In fact, there again the word comes from a root dhru, means which is that which bears, which supports. This dharma, this philosophy of righteousness supports, it's the basis, the foundation of all our activities. All our activities related to worldly life, that should be understood very clearly. Not necessarily our spiritual pursuit. When a man works hard to make money, to build a house, to do business, to teach in a college, or to plough in a field, whatever may be his profession, an engineer or doctor, anybody, all his activities should be guided by certain fundamental values which are collectively called dharma or righteousness. Now, according to Hindu philosophy, Upanishad philosophy, if a man holds fast to these fundamental values, values of righteousness, and tries to enjoy this world, try to live in this world, a time comes when he realizes the transitoriness, the perishable nature of worldly enjoyments. And then he asked the question, what lies beyond? Is there something more than money, more than wealth, more than status? Is there something which is imperishable? Something beyond empirical? This inquiry comes. But this is possible only if an individual holds fast to certain fundamental principles of righteousness. If he deviates from these fundamental values, then he will become a slave of worldly pursuits. He may become a machine, he may become a madman, or he may become a demon. These are three possibilities. He may lead just a mechanical life, or he may lose his spirit, his soul, but he may acquire everything else in this world. Or he may become a demon. So, dharma is the fundamental principle based on which a person can follow the path of artha and kama. Artha actually means something that we need to acquire from something. So money, wealth, all these are things which a man needs to live in this world. Man, these are necessary things. These are the instruments, the tools which a man needs, but these should not become his masters. His instrument should not become his master. His instrument should remain his instrument. So artha, wealth and other necessary tools, and then other desires which every normal man living this world will have. Artha and kama, these two. So he is allowed. Hindu philosophy doesn't ask a man to run away from the world. It permits him to live in this world, enjoy this world, but he should not deviate from the path of the fundamental values, which are collectively called dharma. Now, when he leads a virtuous life, righteous life, without deviating from the path of righteousness or dharma, he realizes that there is something beyond all this. That's why you find people who have worked very hard to make a lot of money, successful businessmen, captains of industry, big scientists, who have made billions of dollars. Then after some time they start donating huge amounts to philanthropic organizations, and they start spending money for righteous pursuits. Right? It at least to get a peace of mind, because at least the most immediate need may be little peace of mind. For that they start donating money, helping charitable organizations and philanthropic societies. Because slowly they realize, well, there is something beyond money. There is something which money cannot bring, which status cannot bring. And then they start thinking of something beyond. They are not at seekers of moksha or the liberation, what is called. That's the last value. Dharma, artha, kama and moksha. But still they have already started feeling the perishable nature of worldly pleasures. There is something beyond this. And then he slowly evolves the next stage of his, not spiritual life, his life as a whole. That is called moksha or the transcendental value. Now, third mantra tells us that a person who forgets this and who's under the delusion that money can bring him everything, wealth can bring him everything, he is living in a world of darkness. He enters the world of pitch darkness. That's the literal meaning of the third mantra. The third mantra actually is a kind of warning, a strong warning to those who are under the wrong notion that they can live in this world without following these fundamental ethical and moral values. So, asurya namate lokaha, anthena tamasa avrutaha, tamste pretya abhigachanti, ekecha atmahano janaha. So, Before the Upanishad takes the man to the higher transcendental level, it gives a strong warning to those who cling fast to matter and material pursuits. And it is Asuryaha Nama. Asurya means those places inhabited by evil men. Actually, this is a, you know, the Upanishad, I should say something about Upanishad language. The Upanishad language is sometimes it is called a kind of occult language. It's not occult language. So Upanishads were written in an age when philosophy was highly evolved, but language was still in its stage of infancy. That is the explanation given by linguists and philologists. So very often this language used in Upanishadic literature is sometimes indirect. So Asurya means a place which is normally inhabited by evil men, though inhabited by ignorant men. And ignorance is a symbol of darkness. The other way also correct, darkness symbolizes ignorance. So Asuryaha Nama Te Lokaha Anthena Tamasa Avrutaha. This is the breakup of the mantra. Yekecha Janaha Atmahanaha Te Pretya Tan Abhigachanti. This is the brief description. The meaning is this. Generally, people who are not aware of any of something beyond the perishable, beyond the material, think that material pleasure is the end of everything. That's why, see, we become slaves of material pleasure because we don't know there is something beyond it. If a wise man realizes there is something beyond the material, then he may live in this world a material life, but he will not be enslaved by it. But those who are ignorant of the ultimate transcendental goal of man's life cling fast to the material life, they become slaves of matter. So that's why this mantra says, such people, when they die, pretya abhigachanti, tan abhigachanti means lokan abhigachanti. That is, tamasa avrutan lokan abhigachanti. This is the description in the Bhashya literature. In short, those who live in this world under the strong conviction that there is nothing beyond the matter, nothing beyond the material pleasure, they enter a world of pitch darkness after their death. This mantra also gives a glimpse of the evolution of human life. You know, in Hindu tradition, we believe in two fundamental principles. That is, one is the theory of rebirth, the other is law of karma. Karma theory doesn't mean that we are slaves or we are just helpless tools in the hands of karma. That's not so. If the present is the result of past, then future can be the result of the present. So karma theory doesn't reduce man's life into a helpless repetition of something that we have done in the past. Rather, karma theory properly interpreted tells us that we are the makers of our own destiny. In fact, this is the essence of Swamiji's Karma Yoga lectures, in the beginning, that long lectures, the series of lectures, Swamiji drives home this point. Karma theory and the theory of rebirth do not reduce human life into helpless mechanisms. It doesn't mean that we are helpless tools in the hands of the mighty karma. If our present life is the result of our past karma, then we can build a future, a better future, with the actions at present. This is what the karma theory says. But this is possible. This improvement of future modification of karma is possible only if a person, if a man is convinced of the imperishable nature of Atman and the perishable nature of matter. If he is convinced that there is something beyond the perishable, beyond the matter, then he will pursue the path of a transcendental value. And then he will live in this world, but he can work as master and not as slaves. But this mantra says, those who do not have this discrimination, they enter the world of pitch darkness. So the word uses Atmahana, means somebody who kills Atman. It means somebody who is ignorant of the true nature of Atman. Otherwise it becomes an endless cycle of life, death, rebirth, again continuation of our activities. Normally we do certain things because our tendency to do that, and this tendency is the result of previous actions, previous life. Through study, through proper thinking, through study of scriptures, we can imbibe noble thoughts and modify our actions and modify our future and improve our future also. Otherwise, it is an endless cycle of life, death and rebirth. But one can come out of this wheel of life, death and rebirth if one understands there is something beyond the perishable matter. And that is the only way to come out of this wheel of karma, wheel of the cyclic progression of life and death. And this idea is accepted not only in Hindu philosophy but also in Buddhist philosophy. Only in Buddhist philosophy the concept of an eternal Atman, an unchanging Atman, which is Satchidananda, which is absolute knowledge and bliss, and which is the all-pervading spiritual reality, this concept is not found in Buddhist philosophy. But the rebirth, the love rebirth and love karma, these are found in Buddhist philosophy also, not taken from Upanishadic Vedic literature only. So after giving this strong warning in the third mantra, the Upanishad next gives a very, very celebrated description of the true nature of Atman. Now, in these two mantras, before entering the fourth and fifth mantra, I should give an idea of how Upanishad literature normally explains the Atman. Atman, I don't want to use the word soul, because the soul is very often understood to mean only mind or intellect. But I would rather stick to the word Atman, because that word has got a great metaphysical significance, spiritual significance in the Upanishad philosophy. Upanishads tell us that Atman cannot be explained, Atman cannot be described, Atman cannot be defined. And the Upanishads tell us, Atmasi yato vajo nivartande aprapya manasasaka. Taittiriya Upanishad tells, to translate in English, mind and words went to describe Atman, went in search of Atman. They could not describe or define Atman. They returned empty-handed. This is what the Upanishads tell us. And sometimes this idea is put in some other language, vajam agocharatva, means Atman cannot be seen. Agojara means that is invisible. It is invisible to words. It can only be experienced. And, you know, anything which can be explained in words will be different from experience. See, Guru Maharaj says in the Gospel, even the sweetness of sugar, you may write a whole book on the sweetness of sugar, but the experience you get while describing or by reading this book will be totally different from the experience of putting one spoonful of sugar in your mouth. Totally different. That's the case of even ordinary, mundane, empirical experiences. The Upanishads tell us the absolute transcendental experience can never be defined. It's called anirvachaniya, vacham agochara, and so on. But then what are these Upanishads? Upanishads are sometimes called Brahmavidya, in a secondary sense. All, in fact, all the great teachers of Upanishads are unanimous in one point. They say, the entire Vedic literature, the entire Upanishad literature, are unsuccessful attempts to explain the inexplicable. But the greatness of Upanishads is this. The Upanishads tell us the reality is beyond us. We cannot explain the Upanishads. Some other religious books may tell us that this is God. But Upanishads tell us God cannot be explained. But then what is the benefit of reading Upanishads? By reading Upanishads, we get an idea of the transcendental nature of that indescribable, inexplicable reality, which can be explained as our own inner experience. But so that's why it is different from the Kantian concept of thing in itself, critical pure reason. Thing in itself is unknown and unknowable. But Upanishads tell us, it is unknown in the sense it cannot be perceived by the five senses and it cannot be defined by words. But it is knowable, it can be known as our own inner reality. That is where the Upanishad philosophy departs from Kantian, from Kantism, Kantian philosophy, Kantian metaphysics. Upanishads tell us the reality can be experienced as our own inner essence. And when we get that experience, it is beyond words. That's why in Brihadaranyaka Upanishad there are some celebrated verses. When you reach that level of experience, we go beyond Vedas, we go beyond Upanishads. This here again, Swami Vivekananda trying to explain this subtle metaphysical, philosophical idea of the Upanishad, tells us, I want to take the humanity beyond the Bible, the Ved, Gita, and beyond the books. That's what Swamiji means. An experience where none of these religious scriptures exist means the experience which is beyond all these scriptures. Scriptures are necessary to tell us that the reality is beyond scriptures. Now, in fact, last day, during one of our discussion in the Vivekananda Hall, somebody put this question, Mandukya Karika, Mandukya Upanishad Mantra. Mandukya Upanishad tells us, na prajnam, na prajnam, na ubhayada prajnam, na prajnanakhanam, and so on. Means, shantam, shivam, madhvedam, chadurtham, manyante, all this mantra comes there. So, the Upanishads, this gives an example. Upanishads normally resort to two types of descriptions while trying to describe the indescribable. Sometimes it tells us Satchidananda. It is the absolute knowledge, bliss, absolute existence, knowledge and bliss. But this is only an attempt to explain. And along with that, the Vedas, Upanishads, reminds us that in reality, this anubhuti or experience is beyond all this. So this is one way of explaining Satchidananda, Surupa Lakshana, sometimes it is called. The absolute existence, knowledge and bliss. Then there is another way of explaining this. There the Upanishad tells us, this is neither the experience in dream state or the experience in waking state or experience in susupti state, neither prajna nor aprajna, like that, go, neither mind nor intellect nor intuition nor thinking, feeling and so on. Now, where the language fails to understand, fails to explain the reality, what is left out? What is left out is the experience. And that experience is beyond description. So to drive home this point that the reality is beyond words, the Upanishad uses words in juxtaposition, either in the absolute Swarupa Lakshana method or in the negative method. So it says it is neither mind, nor intellect, nor body, neither long, nor short, neither light, nor darkness, and so on. And now, can there be anything which is neither light, nor darkness, neither long, nor short, neither intellect, nor mind, anything? There can be nothing of that kind in the empirical, mundane realm. If there is something beyond all this, it is the only inexplicable, indescribable experience. This is the peculiar technique which the Upanishad sages resorted to. In the Vedas also, Nasadiya Sukta, Nasadasi, Nosadasi, Tadani, is another example. In the beginning, there was neither existence nor non-existence. Now, can there be anything which is neither existence nor non-existence? It means it's beyond words. So words are used in such a way as to drive home the idea that reality is beyond words. That is here, you can find this fourth and fifth mantra, you can get an idea of this. These two mantras, if you read together, you will understand this. Aneja dekam manaso jeviyaha nainaddeva apnuvan purvam ashad taddhavataha anyan atyedi tishthat tasmin napo madarishwa dadhati. Now this Atman, it is faster than mind. Mind is faster than anything else, because mind can think, speculate in split seconds. So mind is the fastest that we can imagine, we can conceive of. And Upanishad tells us this Atman is beyond mind, it is faster than mind. So Atma is anejat. First it says anejat means that it doesn't move. And it doesn't move at the same time, it is faster than mind. So you can see the apparent contradiction. Now, it is contradiction only when we look at it from the empirical point of view. If I say this table is neither table nor non-table, it is absolutely contradictory. Because this is something which I can see and feel, is something purely empirical, within the sensory perception. But what is beyond the sensory perception, what is beyond all this, cannot be explained either as moving or non-moving. That's why it says, you know, this Atman is anejat, it doesn't move. It is one. Even the word one is ekam, the Upanishad language, the word, you see, advaitam is said. Advaita means non-dual. Now, why is this non-dual issue? It could be said one. Why should you say non-dual? It means it is neither non-dual nor one. It cannot be even explained as one. Because the moment you say Advaita implies one, then it becomes defined. If you define something, it becomes limited. Anything which is within definition is limited. Definition means limitation. Explanation means limitation. Description means limitation. We are making a frame with four walls, and we are limiting the reality within that when we describe, explain, or define something. So, to imply that reality is beyond description, beyond definition, beyond explanation, the Upanishad tells, Upanishad uses a language which is apparently contradictory, but it is not contradictory. That is the point to be understood here. Anejat, it doesn't move, but then it says manasaha jeviyaha, it is faster than mind. And it is ekam. And then purvam ashat means, when mind goes in search of Atman, it finds that Atman has already reached there. That's why it is Atman is said to be faster than mind. Indriyas also try to reach somewhere and then find Atman has already reached there. Because Atman is all-pervasive, it is omnipresent, it is all-pervading. So you cannot say that it didn't exist when you reached there. When you reach there, you understand Atman is already present there, because Atman is omnipresent, all-pervading. So it is unmoving, at the same time, it is faster than mind. And tishtat dhavataha, these two words should be understood. Tishtat means it remains somewhere. Dhavataha anyan atyedi. This word should be. Dhavataha means that which moves. Anyan means other things. It remains stagnant somewhere. It remains stationary somewhere. At the same time, it outpaces everything else. It outruns everything else. It goes beyond everything else. So it is unmoving. It doesn't move, but it moves faster than mind. It remains stationary somewhere. At the same time, it goes faster than everything else, because it is all-pervading. It is omnipresent. There is nowhere in the world where Atman is not present. There is nothing in the world which is not an expression of Atman, which is not a manifestation, which is not a spirit of Atman. It is not a spark of Atman. That's why, now, if the Upanishad could have straightly said Atman is all-pervading, the subject, the problem would have been solved. But you know, that is the music of Upanishad. That is the way Vedas try to explain things, you know. As I said last time, if you read the Vedic, if you go through the Vedic literature, you can...
And to this city, our Swami Tattva Mayananda Ji.